Good morning and welcome to the Talking Information Center. Today is Saturday, February 21st. We have today's reading of the Boston Globe being read to you by John. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Billy, and good morning, everyone. Our first story, Supreme Court strikes down Trump's tariffs. 6-3 ruling, uncertainty remains as he vows to use other methods. This is by Jim Puzingera of the Globe staff, Dateline, Washington. The Supreme Court on Friday invalidated a large swath of President Trump's sweeping and often chaotic tariffs in a ruling that struck at the controversial centerpiece of his second-term economic and diplomatic strategy. The eagerly awaited decision creates a whole new round of questions for U.S. businesses that have to pay tariffs on imported goods. And the uncertainty hits just as the federal government reported a significant slowdown in economic growth at the end of 2025. The court did not address potential refunds for the tens of billions of dollars in tariffs that importers have sent to the U.S. Treasury since last year. And an angry Trump promised Friday that he would impose a new 10% tariff on global imports under a different law that allows the levies to be in place for only 5 months unless they're approved by Congress. Still, that 10% level is lower than many of the tariffs that were struck down. And about 45% of Trump's tariffs remain in place because they were not enacted using the legal authority the Supreme Court invalidated. I wouldn't call this a total time to celebrate. It's a very difficult issue, said John Hurst, president of the Retailers Association of Massachusetts. We have folks in our membership that are very much wanted to see more fairness for locally sourced goods and more manufacturing jobs coming back into the U.S. Tony Post, chief executive at shoe company Topo Athletic in Framingham, experienced a roller coaster of emotions as he followed the news on Friday. I think the Supreme Court did the right thing, Post said. Then, an hour or two later, as Trump spoke, I'm right back in the same place where there's this tremendous amount of uncertainty. I don't know what the tariffs are going to be. In response to Trump's tariffs last year, Post moved manufacturing for all of his shoes bound for the United States to Vietnam from China. The tariff on shoe imports from Vietnam was 30% after Trump increased it, while China's was nearly twice that amount. If we knew for sure what the tariffs were and what the landscape for the business will be, we could probably invest with more confidence and certainty, said Post, who had to raise shoe prices by 5% last year because of the tariffs. Olu Sanola, head of U.S. economics at Fitch Ratings, one of the three leading credit rating firms, said the ruling eliminated more than $200 billion in U.S. tariff revenue. However, the bigger macro takeaway is not just lower tariffs, but higher tariff regime uncertainty, he said. In a 6-3 ruling written by Chief Justice John Roberts, the Supreme Court determined that Trump exceeded his authority in using the 1977 International Emergency Economic Powers Act to put in place high tariffs on dozens of nations in an often chaotic effort launched last April on what he billed as Liberation Day for the economy. Trump declared an emergency on two fronts, illegal drugs coming from China, Mexico, and Canada, and large trade deficits with many nations. Trump used the tariffs to try to boost U.S. manufacturing, but also as leverage to get concessions from foreign leaders. The tariffs, up to 50% on some imports on top of existing levies, were the highest in decades. They forced U.S. businesses to spend more on imports and to wrestle with how much of those increased costs to pass on to customers already struggling with the high cost of living. Roberts was joined in the ruling by two of his fellow conservatives, Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, as well as the court's three liberal justices. The president asserts the extraordinary power to unilaterally impose tariffs of unlimited amount, duration, and scope, Roberts wrote, noting no other president tried to use the 1977 law that way. Because Trump could not point to clear congressional authorization to exercise that power, the court struck down the tariffs. Conservative Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Brett Kavanaugh dissented. Kavanaugh noted that the majority ruling didn't address the question of refunds of tariffs paid by U.S. businesses and wrote that the process is likely to be a mess. The court ruling infuriated Trump, who has frequently declared tariff his favorite word. For years, he said tariffs are the key to forcing companies to make more products in the United States. Higher tariffs were a major promise in both of his presidential campaigns, but his use of them has been more aggressive in his second term. Trump has touted the hundreds of billions of dollars they've generated, which he's falsely claimed was paid by foreign countries, as a critical boost to the U.S. economy, even as it added to upward pressure on prices. In December, he funneled $12 billion of tariff revenue to farmers hurt by tariffs that foreign countries slapped on U.S. exports in retaliation for Trump's moves. Trump has even suggested the federal government could send out $2,000 tariff dividend checks to Americans. But that seems unlikely now. The Nonpartisan Tax Foundation estimated the invalidated tariffs generated $160 billion, accounting for about 55% of the nation's overall tariff revenue. News of the ruling broke in the middle of a closed-door breakfast Trump was hosting with 22 of the nation's governors. He was handed a note informing him of the court's decision and called it a disgrace before leaving the room, according to one governor who attended but did not want to be quoted. It completely overshadowed what was getting ready to be a very productive meeting with the president, Louisiana Governor Jeff Landry, a Republican, told reporters afterward. Landry called it a bad ruling, but reflecting the sharp partisan split on the issue, New York Governor Kathy Hochul, standing next to him during a news conference, hailed the Supreme Court decision. Like many Democratic officials, Massachusetts Governor Maura Healey also welcomed the news, but warned that the damage has already been done. For a year now, President Trump's tariffs have increased costs on every American and every business, she said in a statement. His chaotic approach has caused instability in our economy, undermined business confidence, and weakened the United States' standing on the world stage. Trump made a surprise visit to the White House briefing room Friday afternoon to blast the justices who voted to invalidate the tariffs, including two of his own appointees, Gorsuch and Barrett. The Supreme Court's ruling on tariffs is deeply disappointing, and I'm ashamed of certain members of the court, absolutely ashamed, for not having the courage to do what's right for our country, Trump said. But he said he had great alternatives to the emergency authority the Supreme Court invalidated. Those mechanisms, though, are more complicated and limited. The tariffs have been a major burden for Curio Spice Company of Cambridge, which imports spices from around the world that it grinds and mixes at its factory in Winchester. While Nikki Levitch, the company's vice president of operations and finance, said she was relieved Curio will face lower tariffs on spices that aren't produced in the United States, that won't make up for the damage already done. What we won't get back is all the time and energy that we had to sink into completely rejiggering our strategy for 2025, Levitch said. When it's tens of thousands of dollars and you're a small business, that's a big impact. Okay, next up. After Rhode Island shooting, trying to regroup. While the coach made sure the players were safe, three men, including a dad of one of the hockey players, leapt into action to subdue the gunman. Then the coach returned to the scene to help the victims. This is by Christopher Gavin and Steph Mikado of the Globe staff, Dateline Pawtucket, Rhode Island. It was supposed to be a special night. Senior night was a coming together of the local hockey community to celebrate the outgoing upperclassmen. Inside Dennis M. Lynch Arena on Monday, there were proud families, flowers for moms, handshakes and hugs for coaches, gifts for the senior student athletes who were starting a new chapter after this season. The Blackstone Valley Schools co-op hockey team started the game with two quick goals against the Coventry Johnston co-op team, said Chris Labrizi, head coach of the Blackstone team. The kids were very excited and celebrating, Labrizi said. They were flying high. And then the joy, the buzz, the energy, it was all shattered. Labisi thought he heard a balloon pop loudly. No more than 2 seconds after that, there was a pop, 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 Labisi said. I screamed to the kids, get down. And then one of my other coaches said, gunfire. In the crowded stands, Robert Dorgan had started shooting, firing a barrage of bullets at members of their family who were at the game to cheer on their own, a 17-year-old captain on Labisi's team. The shooter killed their ex-wife, Rhonda Dorgan, and their 23-year-old son, Aiden Dorgan, and wounded Rhonda Dorgan's parents and her friend before taking out another gun and dying by suicide. Ryan Cordero, the father of another player on the Blackstone Valley team, was sitting two rows above the Dorgan family, and he recognized the shooter from previous games. Dorgan, who was transgender, also went by Roberta Dorgan and Roberta Esposito. Family, friends, and officials said Dorgan's preferred pronouns were unclear. When the shooting started, Cordero didn't realize what was going on until he saw smoke coming off of Aiden Dorgan's yellow Merrimack College hockey jersey. Aiden Dorgan had lunged at his father before being shot, Cordero said, apparently trying to protect his mother. He knew what was happening right away, Cordero said. He jumped right on his dad, no hesitation. Three bystanders, Michael Black, Robert Ratney, and Cordero, all threw themselves at Dorgan, police said. Black got there first, jamming his hand into the gun's trigger mechanism. Ratney had Dorgan in a headlock. Then Cordero leaped on top of them from above. Cordero said Dorgan was strong, and it took all three to take him down into the bleachers. I was on top of him, and he got a gun out of his top pocket, put it in his mouth, and pulled the trigger, Cordero said. I literally heard his teeth clench on the gun. Amid the initial gunfire, Labisi had his players rush out of the arena through a door behind the team's bench, he said. In their hockey gear, they ran into nearby stores and restaurants. Some still had ice skates strapped to their feet, running through grass and on cement, he said. Some ran in their socks, others with bare feet. Cordero reunited with his son outside in the parking lot. While he was trying to take down the gunman, his son had escaped with his teammates. We just hugged and cried, Cordero said. Labisi tried to call 911, but the line was jammed with others calling for help, he said. Once he heard the gunfire quiet down, he went back into the arena. A retired Warwick firefighter and EMT, Labisi, 60, grabbed the large medical bag that he kept handy at every game and joined the others who were frantically trying to save the people who were shot, he said. Excuse me. Police have said Labisi, Glenn Narodowi, who worked with Labisi at the fire department, and a nurse, Marianne Ratney, provided first aid at the scene. I just started pulling trauma dressings and bandages out of my bag and started assisting victims that were impacted by this, trying to make a difference, Labisi said. Aiden Dorgan was the first person Labisi approached, he said. He wasn't alone, Labisi said. We were there with him, holding his hand and trying to calm him down. Years earlier, Labisi had coached against him, a talented hockey player and athlete in his own right. The 23-year-old became part of the Blackstone Valley hockey family with his younger brother on the team. Just weeks ago, Aiden Dorgan said Aiden Dorgan and his mother had joined the team for a trip to Lake Placid, New York, Labisi said. Rhonda Dorgan died in the arena. Aiden Dorgan died soon after at the hospital. Aiden Dorgan died a true hero, Labisi said. He was holding his mom the whole time, protecting her, even when he had a gunshot wound in his back. For about 30 years, Labisi, a father of two who has been battling cancer in his left eye since 2021, worked as a first responder and a fire investigator. He has responded to some really horrific fires over the years, he said. None of that comes even close to what he experienced the day of the shooting, he said. This is by far the worst week of my life, he said. He had to treat his friends, people that I cared about, who were suffering from gunshot wounds. Among those injured in the shooting were Rhonda Dorgan's parents, Linda and Gerald Dorgan, both 75, and Thomas Geruso, 54, and assistant principal at Charles E. Shea High School in Pawtucket. All three remained hospitalized in critical condition on Friday. Labrizzi had to go into the parking lot to tell the youngest Dorgan about his mother, he said, and then get him to the hospital with the rest of his family. By far the most difficult part, Labrizzi said. The days since the shooting have been long. Labrizzi's team has met every day for counseling sessions, beginning on Monday night, just hours after the violence unfolded, he said. They've been having dinners together, too. There remains a long road ahead for all of them, but they're taking their first steps, Labrizzi said. He's heard some laughter returning, and his players are intent on getting back on the ice for the upcoming playoffs, determined not to let what happened put an end to their season, he said. After the blades of their skates were ruined by the concrete outside the arena on Monday, the hockey players received new ones donated by the Providence Bruins, Cordero said. Bauer Hockey, a manufacturer of hockey equipment, donated new hockey sticks for the team and $10,000 to an online fundraiser for Rhonda Dorgan's surviving children. The team's game on Wednesday was canceled. They plan to play again together next week, somewhere other than Lynch Arena. These kids don't want to sit at home doing nothing, Cordero said. They want to be together. Labrizzi had intended this season to be his last of a 32-year coaching career, he said. But that will likely change. I cannot go out and leave my kids on a note like this, he said. He's been spending time with Rhonda Dorgan's surviving children, 20-year-old Ava Dorgan, and the 17-year-old son who plays on the Blackstone Valley team, he said. Both have a great family network of support and support from the team, he said. The younger son will be returning to the ice to finish the season, Labrizzi said. I'll be at graduation, whatever he needs, Labrizzi said. Moving forward, we're here to support him, and we will be here with him for years to come. Okay, next up. Governor's dinner divided by Trump. Many Democrats, including Healey, chose to boycott. This is by Jim Puzangera of the Globe staff, Dateline, Washington. It's supposed to be a rare respite from partisanship, an opportunity for the president and the nation's governors to break bread and commit to jointly solving America's problems. But President Trump has turned a routine annual tradition into a political food fight. And the controversy that has erupted over the White House dinner for the National Governors Association on Saturday highlights the difficulties many Democrats face in balancing their opposition to Trump with the need to work with him in the interest of their states. It's not a perfect relationship. I'm not going to lie to you there, Delaware Governor Matt Meyer, who has clashed with Trump over an offshore wind project, said Thursday at the hotel where the governors are holding their winter meeting. It doesn't help when the president and his divisive language and policymaking is coming out of the federal administration, but I'm here to collaborate with my other governors and see what are ways that we can work together. But that tone of collaboration won't be reflected in the attendance at Saturday's White House dinner. After some initial confusion over whether only Republican governors were invited, Trump said on Truth Social last week the dinner was open to all except for two Democrats, Wes Moore of Maryland and Colorado's Jared Polis. Trump has ongoing disputes with both. He's had particularly sharp clashes with Moore, a rising Democratic star and the nation's only black governor, who's also vice chair of the Governors Association. The exclusions didn't sit well with some of their fellow governors, including the NGA's Republican chair, Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt. Stitt said the NGA would not officially organize the dinner or a working breakfast with Trump on Friday morning, but leave it up to each governor to decide whether they would attend. And 18 Democratic governors, including Meyer, Maura Healey of Massachusetts, Dan McKee of Rhode Island, and Janet Mills of Maine, publicly declared they would skip the traditional dinner on Saturday. Several, including Healey, are also skipping the White House breakfast on Friday. President Trump has made this whole thing a farce. He doesn't want to work together, Healey said in a statement Thursday, adding the president is afraid to hear the truth about the effects of his policies. As governor, I work with people of all parties to get things done, but if the president doesn't want a serious discussion about how we can deliver for the American people, then we aren't going to waste our time. Also joining the boycott of the dinner is Vermont Republican Governor Phil Scott. The NGA is important. It's bipartisanship, Scott told reporters earlier in February. We need to bring our country back together, and there's no better area to do that than, I think, the National Governor Association's longstanding tradition of going to the White House. Trump was greeted with applause Friday morning by the 22 governors, 12 Republicans, and 10 Democrats, who attended the breakfast in the state dining room along with some cabinet secretaries. Moore, who had said he'd skip the event earlier in the week, appeared to have reconsidered and was present at the breakfast. But unlike last year's working session with the governors, which was televised, Trump asked the media to leave after about a minute on Friday. Afterward, Moore told reporters it was a productive meeting, despite the controversy leading up to it. Stitt's decision to pull the NGA's official backing of the White House events angered Trump, who branded the conservative as a rhino, a Republican in name only. But Stitt said he was simply honoring the organization's history of bipartisanship. Republicans and Democrats alternate chairing the group each year, with a governor from the other party serving as vice chair. You can invite whoever you want to the White House, but it can't be an NGA event if it's not inclusive of all 50 governors, Stitt said during a joint appearance with Moore on Wednesday, hosted by the Economic Club of Washington, D.C. Stitt said he still supports Trump and plans to attend the White House breakfast and dinner. Moore said that despite the snub, the governors still would be working across party lines on immigration, transportation, and other problems. It's reminding all the governors that the NGA is bigger than who sits in the White House, Moore said Thursday during another joint appearance with Stitt at a Politico event. That bond is stronger than one person. The annual White House dinner with the governors is not usually controversial, stressing cooperation over confrontation. Before toasting the governors at the 2003 dinner, Republican President George W. Bush, a former governor himself, said, "I believe if we work together, we can do a lot of good things." Former Arizona Democratic Governor Janet Napolitano was at the 2003 dinner as the NGA chair and said the controversy this year sends the wrong signal to the American people. What a missed opportunity to have all the nation's governors in one place at one time, working with and not against an administration, she told the Globe. It's just partisan silliness run amok. Working across party lines is more difficult for Democratic governors, given Trump's efforts to target Democratic-run states with investigations and withholding of federal money, Napolitano said. But Democrats still need to try. New York Governor Kathy Hochul has been negotiating with the White House over the release of millions of dollars in funding for a Hudson River Tunnel project Trump had frozen. Healy has pushed Trump to keep open a new federal medical research hub in Cambridge. And McKee and Meyer have been fighting Trump's attempts to shut down offshore wind projects. When the governors met with Trump last winter, he clashed in front of the cameras with Mills over Maine's policy of allowing transgender athletes to compete in women's and girls' sports. Mills said she was just following state and federal law and would see Trump in court. Trump said he welcomed it. "I look forward to that. That should be a real easy one," Trump said. "Enjoy your life after governor, because I don't think you'll be in elected politics." Several weeks later, the Trump administration sued Maine for not complying with an executive order banning transgender athletes in women's and girls' sports. The case is ongoing. Meanwhile, Mills, who cannot run for governor again because of term limits, is now seeking the Democratic nomination for Senate to challenge incumbent Republican Susan Collins. Healy told the Globe Friday that she had no regrets about skipping this year's White House breakfast with Trump, but still will try to find ways to engage administration officials. "I continue to be somebody who wants to work with the federal administration when it is advancing the interests of the people of Massachusetts," she said. "And where they do things that are harmful to the people of Massachusetts, I'm going to continue to push back and fight back." Polis said it was a badge of honor in his circles not to be dining with Trump, but he still planned to try to work with him. Trump said on Truth Social last week that he would welcome all the governors who come to the White House. I look forward to seeing the Republican governors and some of the Democrats governors who were worthy of being invited, but most of whom won't show up, he wrote. Okay. Next up. Can brain training make everything okay? Just use your head. Brain health has become the new wellness frontier, but who has the time to fight off dementia? This is by Beth Titel of the Globe staff. Will these people never leave us alone? Researchers have released yet another brain health study, this one finding that people who played a speed training video game for a mere 23 hours dramatically reduced their risk of dementia for up to 2 decades. Oh, great. Just what I need. Another simple intervention I'm not doing. Arm day, leg day, and now frontal lobe day. Brain health has become the new microbiome. Or maybe it's the new protein or fiber or strength training, pickleball, breath work, or longevity, or everything rolled into one hideous ball of self-improvement pressure. If you're not micro-dosing lithium orotate and your friends are, or if you haven't even heard about the 2025 Harvard Medical School study, albeit in mice, that showed lithium could explain and treat Alzheimer's, good luck to you. My cognitive improvement calendar is woefully empty. I'm not playing Sudoku, Ken, or Picross. I'm not searching for word patterns or participating in the fiber arts. I'm not relentlessly socializing, forcing my conversation on people for my own selfish reasons as they seek to flee. Nothing can be done for pure pleasure anymore. I know one baby boomer who's taking drawing lessons mainly to improve his brain function, and another who's memorizing jokes for the same reason. I should be learning to play the piccolo, not to play the solo in Sousa's The Stars and Stripes Forever or anything, but for my frontal lobe. Given life's pace, it's hard to fit it all in, to work, do laundry, to copy and paste two-factor authentication codes. We need a multitasking game that trains your brain and also rewards knowledge of, say, the Epstein files. Here's an idea. Photos of global elites flash by on your screen, and you have to speed click on those whose names surfaced on his plane's flight manifest. Or you're given a list of presidents, academics, bankers, and philanthropists who claim to have stopped socializing with the sexual predator before his 2008 conviction. And from memory, you have to name those who were caught exchanging cozy emails with him years later. Meanwhile, I never thought I'd see gingivitis as a blessing, but now that I know that flossing can also reduce the risk of dementia, I'm all in. In case you missed it, in late January, the journal Stroke reported for every 14 individuals who floss less than once a week, one fewer person will develop dementia. That's all it takes, 14 people, and this whole individual and family-destroying condition could be greatly reduced. Please, if you're one of those 14 individuals, I'm begging you, please pull out that Glide. Brain training is interfering with the very relationships we're told to nurture on our brain's behalf. Last night, I was supposed to meet friends for dinner at 6:30, but one had to push it to 7 because of brain training conflict. It was pickleball, which has rebranded to emphasize its cognition benefits. And another had to be home by 7:30 to give herself time to meditate, write in her gratitude journal, and make it to bed by 9 so she could play games on her phone and work on her processing speed. Cognitive decline has, of course, entered the marital dance. A friend whose husband's late parents had dementia has been nagging him to get in shape brain-wise. On a recent Tuesday, the spouse was proudly playing word games and drinking coffee, which, of course, was itself the subject of another recently released study, this one reporting that moderate consumption is linked to slower brain aging. No dementia for me until Wednesday at the earliest, he texted. The big question is, what training, if any, helps you in the real world? I mean, if the only thing you're training your brain to do by playing Wordle is to play Wordle, maybe we can skip it guilt-free. I put the question to George Reebok, a professor emeritus of mental health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, who was involved in the recently released speed training study, Active. Excuse me. Reebok, who often wears a t-shirt with the brain on it, swag from a cognitive aging conference, told me that he gets the question a lot. And it's like asking if drugs work, he said, allowing himself a chuckle. Yeah, they can work, but it depends on the condition. The dosage, there are a lot of factors. It's not as simple as yes or no. It's crucial to find a brain exercise you like, he said, or you're not going to do it. Do it with a friend so there's a memory buddy. Or get a personal trainer, yes, for your brain. And alas, no telling yet whether the buff will flock to the specialty. I still wasn't sure whether all these brain games were nothing more than mind games, and when I asked Reebok for the name of a skeptic, but one who's respected, he immediately directed me to Walter R. Boot, a geriatrics professor and associate director of the Center on Aging and Behavioral Research at Weill Cornell Medicine. And you know what? Bless Reebok for that, because right away Boot told me he was indeed skeptical. It's incredible, and not in a good way, he said, that 20 hours of an activity 20 years later could produce such a striking impact. The study found the game could cut dementia risk by 25%. Seems implausible. Should I be embarrassed to admit that I was almost relieved to hear this? Obviously, yes. Moving on. What I tell people, he said, is that cognitive health is shaped by many factors. He listed controllable lifestyle factors that may make a difference: learning new skills, spending time with friends, exercising, managing your blood pressure, staying engaged. As far as the brain training games, he said, there's a lot of hype and a lot of good science being done in this area. But in terms of translation from lab to the real world, there are things we don't know. But you know what we do know? That our fear of cognitive decline is being monetized. One forecast by Towards Healthcare, a consulting firm based in Canada and India, projected the global digital brain health market would hit $478.53 billion by 2034. Needless to say, dementia has been sucked into the wellness machine. A publication called Spavilus declared that we're in a new era of neuro-wellness spa innovation. With the growing prevalence of dementia, the publication reported with good cheer, there is a rising demand for treatments aimed at mental wellness. Neuro-wellness at a high-end spa? Cue the White Lotus theme song. Okay. Next up. Trump says he doesn't know if aliens are real, but directs government to release files on UFOs and more. President Trump said he's directing the Pentagon and other government agencies to identify and release files related to extraterrestrials and UFOs because of tremendous interests. This is by Michelle L. Price of the Associated Press, Dateline, Washington. President Trump said Thursday that he's directing the Pentagon and other government agencies to identify and release files related to extraterrestrials and UFOs because of tremendous interest. Trump made the announcement in a social media post hours after he accused former President Barack Obama of disclosing classified information when Obama recently suggested in a podcast interview that aliens were real. Trump told reporters aboard Air Force One, "I don't know if they're real or not," and said of Obama, I may get him out of trouble by declassifying. It was the latest effort by Trump, ever the television showman, to stir anticipation for the release of secret government documents, even as he has continued to lash out at reporters over the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files and his connections to the disgraced financier. The release of the Epstein files has dragged on for nearly a year, and Trump did not set a timeline for files on aliens. In a post on his social media platform Thursday night, Trump said he was directing government agencies to release files related to alien and extraterrestrial life, unidentified aerial phenomena, UAP, and unidentified flying objects, UFOs, and any and all other information connected to these highly complex but extremely interesting and important matters. Obama, who made his comments in a podcast appearance over the weekend, later clarified that he had not seen evidence that aliens have made contact with us, but said statistically the universe is so vast that the odds are good there's life out there. Obama's remarks pinballed across the internet as commentators speculated about what he had meant. Obama later clarified on social media that he meant that extraterrestrial life likely exists out in the universe, but that as far as he knew, they had not visited Earth. He insisted, "I saw no evidence during my presidency that extraterrestrials have made contact with us." Really? Trump told reporters Thursday that when it came to the prospect of extraterrestrial visitors, "I don't have an opinion on it. I never talk about it. A lot of people do. A lot of people believe it." Trump's daughter-in-law, Lara Trump, suggested this week that he was ready to speak about it, however, when she said on a podcast that the president had a speech prepared to deliver on aliens that he would give at the right time. That was news to the White House. Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt responded with a laugh when she was asked about it Wednesday and told reporters, "A speech on aliens would be news to me." Public interest in unidentified flying objects and the possibility of the government hiding secrets of extraterrestrial life reemerged in the public consciousness after a group of former Pentagon and government officials leaked Navy videos of unknown objects to the New York Times and Politico in 2017. The renewed scrutiny prompted Congress to hold the first hearings on UFOs in 50 years in May 2022, though officials said that the objects, which appeared to be green triangles floating above a Navy ship, were likely drones. Since then, the Pentagon has promised more transparency on the topic. In July 2022, it created the All-Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, or AARO, which was intended to be a central place to collect reports of all military UFO encounters, taking over from a department task force. In 2023, Dr. Sean Kirkpatrick, the head of AARO at the time, told reporters he didn't have any evidence of any program having ever existed as a to do any sort of reverse engineering of any sort of extraterrestrial unidentified aerial phenomena. The information that has been made public shows that the vast majority of UFO reports made by the military go unsolved, but the ones that are identified as largely benign in nature. An 18-page unclassified report submitted to Congress in June 2024 said service members had made 485 reports of unidentified phenomena in the past year, but 118 cases were found to be prosaic objects, such as various types of balloons, birds, and unmanned aerial systems. It's important to underscore that to date, AARO has discovered no evidence of extraterrestrial beings, activity, or technology, the report stressed. Okay. Next up. NASA plans moon mission in March. Dateline Cape Canaveral, Florida. NASA aims to send astronauts to the moon in March. After acing the latest rocket fueling test, officials announced the decision Friday, 2 weeks ahead of the first targeted launch opportunity on March 6. "This is really getting real, and it's time to get serious and start getting excited," said Lori Glaze, NASA's Exploration Systems Development Chief. Administrator Jared Isaacman noted that launch teams made major progress between the first countdown rehearsal which was disrupted by hydrogen leaks earlier this month, and the second test, which was completed with exceptionally low seepage Thursday night. The test was a big step toward America's return to the lunar environment, Isaacman said on the social media platform X, astronauts last ventured to the moon more than half a century ago. While more work remains at the pad, officials express confidence in being ready to launch four astronauts on the Artemis II lunar fly around as soon as March 6 from Florida's Kennedy Space Center. To keep their options open, the three Americans and one Canadian prepared to go into the mandatory two-week health quarantine Friday night in Houston. The space agency has only 5 days in March to launch the crew aboard the Space Launch System rocket before standing down until the end of April. February's opportunities evaporated after dangerous amounts of liquid hydrogen leaked during the first fueling demonstration. Technicians replaced two seals, leading to Thursday's successful rerun. The countdown clocks went all the way down to the desired 29-second mark. The removed Teflon seals had some light scratches, but nothing else noticeable that could have caused such heavy leakage, officials said. A bit of moisture also was found in the area that could have contributed to the problem. The fixes worked with barely any leakage detected, said launch director Charlie Blackwell Thompson. Commander Reed Weissman and two of his crew monitored Thursday's operation alongside launch controllers. The astronauts will be the first to fly to the moon since Apollo 17 closed out NASA's first chapter in moon exploration in 1972. Ukrainian women tell their stories of sexual violence by Russian soldiers. This is by Sarah Kinkarova of the New York Times. Hundreds of Ukrainian women and girls have reported sexual violence by Russian troops during the nearly 4 years of full-scale war in Ukraine, according to Ukrainian authorities and aid groups. The actual number of victims, advocates say, is likely far higher. Some of the women say they've been impregnated by Russian soldiers and live with children who will forever remind them of their attackers. Others have told of being forced to serve as sex slaves for entire companies of Russian troops. Still others say their life became a waking nightmare after they were incapacitated and raped by Russian forces. The New York Times spoke with more than a dozen women who said they had been sexually abused by Russian troops. Most of the women asked that their full identities be withheld to protect their privacy. Although details of their claims could not be independently verified, the Times reviewed criminal complaints and medical records related to many of their cases and spoke with advocates familiar with the women's accounts. The Kremlin has said that many reports by Ukrainian women of sexual violence were groundless. It did not respond to a request for comment. For Ukraine, the sexual violence is a largely hidden trauma. Advocates say many women are reluctant to file cases because they want to avoid stigma and painful memories, or because they live in territory that remains occupied by Russia and have little hope of legal redress. Some women have broken the cycle of silence, helped by survivor groups or motivated to shed light on what they call atrocities that Russia has used as a weapon of war. Here are some of their stories. Lesya, I thought that was it for me. On March 7, 2022, 2 weeks into Russia's invasion, Lesya, a 53-year-old economist, and her husband Sasha heard a knock on their door in a village near Kyiv, Ukraine's capital. Two Russian soldiers burst in, she said. One of them caught her and dragged her into a neighbor's house, she recalled. He raped me straight away, Lesya said. The second one shot my husband in the stomach and leg while I was being raped. Four other Russian soldiers approached the house where she was being violated, she said. I thought that was it for me. They had knives, rifles, and grenades, Lesya recalled. But the soldiers stopped her attacker and pulled him away, she said. She then searched for her husband, she said. She found him bleeding on the floor of another house. Neighbors were attempting first aid. Lesya begged the Russian troops to allow her to drive her husband to the hospital, she said, but they would not let her get in her car. Sasha died in Lesya's arms 2 days after he was shot, she said. Svitlana, I wanted to get an abortion. Svitlana, 31, was already worried about her four-week-old son, who had been born in fragile health and had lost access to medical care after the Russian army invaded her village in southern Ukraine. Then Russian soldiers stormed her home and threatened to kidnap the boy and take him to Russia, she said. She intervened and they relented, she said. But even after that frightening encounter in March 2022, her partner, the baby's father, began to befriend the troops. The father, a Russian sympathizer, invited them frequently into their home and drank with them, she said. One day, as the men gathered, her partner forced her into a white van with two soldiers, she said. The soldiers put a mask over her face, she said, and drove her to a nearby village. Svitlana's partner stayed in the van while one of the soldiers forced her into a shop and raped her twice, she said. Afterwards, Svitlana's partner accompanied her back to their house without saying a word, she said. 6 months later, Svitlana fled to another village with her baby and four other children from previous relationships. She and her partner had split up, but Svitlana soon noticed that her stomach was growing. A pregnancy test came back positive. I wanted to get an abortion, she recalled. I went to the hospital, but they said it was too late. I was 23 weeks pregnant. Svitlana's baby boy, Yaroslav, was born on March 8, 2023. The regional prosecutor's office said it was investigating the case and that it had received a report from a gynecologist who treated Svitlana. Tetyana, it was the worst of all the prisons. When Russian troops occupied the city of Berdansk in southeastern Ukraine on the night of February 26, 2022, Tetyana Typakova decided to resist. Typakova, 53, a former student leader and an entrepreneur, wrapped herself in a Ukrainian flag and organized anti-Russian protests. She delivered speeches in front of City Hall and recorded videos for social media. Less than a month later, Typakova said Russian troops grabbed her inside her home, handcuffed her, put a bag over her head, and drove her to a prison colony, she said. I knew that place. It was the worst of all the prisons. In Berdansk, she said. There, she was tortured for 7 days, she said. On the fourth day, she said, she was driven to grounds outside the prison where guards had set up a mock execution by firing squad. Typakova was subjected to psychologically and physically abusive interrogations, as well as beatings and electric shocks. She said she was sexually assaulted by prison guards. The abuse continued, she said, until she agreed to film a social media video acknowledging that anti-Russian protests were a mistake. She was released and then fled to the city of Zaporizhia, where she now leads a charity that aids internally displaced persons. Next up, as Trump considers second Iran attack, it could be deadlier than the first. Experts predict second U.S. attack could be longer. This is by Mark Mazzetti and Helene Cooper of the New York Times. Dateline Washington. President Trump is considering committing the United States to another military campaign against Iran, a decision that carries the risk of igniting a conflict that could prove to be longer, deadlier, and far more dangerous than last year's 12-day war. In June, the United States joined a campaign against Iran that Israel had begun, and Trump gave the military a specific goal to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities and set back Tehran's ability to one day make a nuclear weapon. Within days of the U.S. strikes, all sides agreed to a ceasefire. There were no American casualties. Now the Pentagon is in the midst of the largest military buildup in the Middle East in 2 decades, and Trump is considering a far more expansive operation, this time led by U.S. forces, without saying publicly what he hopes to achieve. Would a campaign once again be focused on Iran's nuclear sites? Would there be additional strikes to eviscerate Iran's ballistic missile arsenal, which Iran has insisted it would not give up through negotiation? Or could Trump's goal be something he has often said was dangerous folly, using the military to remove a government in the Middle East from power? A war for regime change could lead to untold civilian deaths in Iran and a wider conflict across the region. The president told reporters Friday that he was weighing a limited military strike to pressure Iran into a deal. "I guess I can say I am considering that," he said at the start of a meeting with governors at the White House. The ambiguity around Trump's aims could, according to some U.S. officials and Middle East experts, be particularly dangerous, as it may lead Iran's government to see a U.S.-led offensive as an existential threat. As a result, Iran could escalate the conflict against the United States and Israel in ways it did not during the attacks in June, or after the U.S. military assassinated General Qassem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Revolutionary Guard, in 2020. In a letter Thursday to the United Nations Secretary General, the head of Iran's UN mission said that if Iran was attacked, then all bases, facilities, and assets of the hostile force in the region would constitute legitimate targets, and that the United States would bear full and direct responsibility for any unpredictable and uncontrolled consequences. That could put the 30,000 to 40,000 U.S. troops currently stationed at 13 military bases across the Middle East at particular risk. Pentagon officials have been scrambling to move more air defense batteries to the region to protect the bases. In June, Iran launched a volley of missiles against U.S. troops at Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, but Iranian officials privately warned U.S. and Qatari officials in advance. This time could be different, as a senior Pentagon official acknowledged earlier this week. U.S. troops could be at much greater risk, he said, if the United States, not Israel, initiates this round of strikes. Israel, of course, could still take on the brunt of any Iranian retaliation. During the conflict in June, Iran launched hundreds of long-range missiles at government, military, and civilian targets in Israel. Israeli military officials said they succeeded in intercepting more than 80% of the missiles, yet the barrage still did extensive damage and killed several dozen Israeli civilians. The Iranian missile attacks forced Israel to begin conserving its supply of interceptors, and some Israeli officials in recent weeks have warned that a much longer conflict could strain the country's ability to defend cities in Israel. Iran faces its own risky calculus if it considers a full-scale retaliation against U.S. troops or Israeli cities, something that would be an enormous gamble for a regime whose paramount goal is survival, said Karim Sajjadpour, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. It could lead Trump and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel to escalate further than originally planned, to make the ultimate goal of the war to bring down Iran's government. The formidable array of American ships, jets, bombers, drones, surveillance aircraft, and air defense units headed to the Middle East is the most tangible evidence that the Pentagon sees the prospect of war lasting beyond 12 days. "This looks like positioning for a much longer conflict," said Catherine Thompson of the Cato Institute, who was a senior policy official at the Defense Department during the first year of the Trump administration. "The Pentagon appears to be anticipating an Iranian response that could be a significant risk to American bases in the region," she said. But even with advanced planning, Thompson said, the Pentagon is always aware that it has a finite supply of missile interceptors to protect its bases or Israeli cities, and that a protracted conflict could force difficult decisions. "The ability of the United States to sustain a prolonged defense of its forces and basing in the region while also supporting Israel's defense is a major concern," she said. A second U.S. military official said that U.S. Central Command is keeping two aircraft carriers deployed in the Middle East at a considerable distance from Iran to protect them from becoming a target. Officials also noted that it was difficult to hit an aircraft carrier traveling at speed with a ballistic missile. In addition, the carriers are escorted by destroyers, which have the ability to shoot down ballistic missiles. And that looks like all the time that we have for today. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the rest of the day.